calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. Welcome to our program. Harry Binswanger. Harry, am I pronouncing your name right? Binswanger?
Right.
Great. Harry Binswanger, professor of philosophy at the Ayn Rand Institute, taught at Hunter College in New York City and the University of Texas at Austin, is with us. AYNRAND.org, Ayn Rand's website. One of those topics here where I have a feeling we're going to have some agreements and some disagreements, Harry. The question that you pose is: religion irrational and destructive to human life?
Tom?
Yeah.
No phone.
Okay, Harry, I'm going to put you on hold, and we're going to have to let the folks in New York figure out what the deal is here. We're on it. Okay, good. Okay, I'm guessing something's not. Anyhow, we're gonna dial him back. Is religion irrational and destructive to human life? Harry makes these points, and I'll wait for him to come back on, and we'll let him make those points. In the meantime, fascinating stuff in the news. In Iraq, we are creating terrorists at an incredible rate. We're learning now that the woman, for example, who showed up in Jordan to blow up the hotel, lost three brothers in Fallujah. In the invasion of Fallujah, where now it's come out, the U.S. government has admitted that we were using phosphorus-based weapons. Phosphorus is a metal that combusts, it combines with oxygen, burns, just on exposure to air, and just goes nuts. And that we were using these, you know, essentially banned weapons by the Third Geneva Convention in Fallujah. And this is where she's from. Tragic, absolutely tragic story. I believe Harry is back with us. Harry, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, let's try this again. Tell me your story on religion here.
Well, I think religion is not only false, I think it's a scourge on mankind. It's an attack on the basis of morality, which is the value of the individual life, and it's attack on the mind, which is our only tool of survival.
How so?
How is the mind the only tool of survival, or how?
No, how is it an attack? How is it an attack on the mind?
Oh, because it's irrational. It's just like people believing in the Hale-Bopp comet is going to take them to outer space.
Well, let's take this for a second. You look at something. I'm assuming right now, right in front of your eyes, you're looking at something.
Right.
How do you know it's there? Okay. How do you know your computer's there?
That's an inversion of the hierarchy of knowledge. We know by direct awareness the evidence of our senses. That's an absolute. Your senses cannot deceive you. They are always registering the only thing they can register.
But Harry, your senses are deceiving you. That computer that's in front of you.
Knowledge that's fallible is conceptual knowledge, where you reason things out on the basis of what you perceive. So to ask...
Let me finish this point here.
Okay.
Harry, the computer in front of you is mostly empty space. You and I both know that intellectually.
No, I don't.
You don't know intellectually that it's mostly empty space?
I not only don't know it, I hold the opposite.
You've never studied atomic principles?
Excuse me?
Yeah, I'm talking at the level of atoms.
Yes, I don't believe that there's a void between the atoms. This is a kind of complex technical philosophy of physics question, but I believe that there's reality everywhere, that there are no vacuums, pure vacuums, that there's something everywhere. There's no there if there's no thing.
Okay, so you're expressing your religious belief here about the nature of reality.
No, I'm expressing a view that I have rational arguments for. You might agree or disagree, but I'm not saying, I read in the Bible that there's no void.
Well, this takes me back to the point that I was making earlier, and that's why I asked you, how do you know that the computer was there? And presumably it would be that your senses are telling you that. And I would suggest to you, I would submit to you, that most people who describe themselves as either religious or spiritual, and I personally make a distinction, but I suspect it's a too subtle a distinction for most people to make, unless they really, you know, seriously think about it, would say that at some point or sometime in their life, they have had an experience a direct experience. It's as real to them
with
as looking
organ?
At the computer is to you.
With what sense organ?
Well, the sense organ that the sense organ that you're using right now to see the computer is your brain.
No, it's eyes. Retina of my eyes is stimulated by light, which can be measured by instruments, and we know the physiology.
That is just raw data that is being interpreted by your brain as a computer.
Processed by my brain to give me the form of awareness of a computer, yes, and that's automatic and infallible. It's not subject to interpretation or error. It's just what the sensory system produces. It's an absolute.
Harry, do you believe in love?
Yeah.
Where do you experience it?
Where do I experience it? Love is not
with what organ?
I do not believe that love is a perception. That's exactly my point. Thank you, Tom. That's exactly my point. An emotion is not a tool of cognition. The senses are tools of cognition. They give us data about reality.
No, cognition is a process. And sensory information is data. And emotion is sensory information just as much as assuming
that,
you're assuming that my description of religion is an emotion. I don't believe it is. I believe it's an actual experience. But nonetheless, we're counting how many angels are on the head of a pin.
You're trying to blur, with all due respect, Tom, you're trying to blur the distinction between a scientist who looks at a phenomenon, either with his eyes or a microscope, and a person who says, oh, I had a vision that the Virgin Mary came and told me X. And those are not comparable. One is the basis of science. The other is psychological aberration. They're not the same at all.
But if somebody experiences something as real,
yeah,
then who are you to tell them that it's not?
I'm a philosopher, that's so.
Well, so but I can tell you that your experience of love is not real. You're imagining love.
They know themselves it's not real.
No, I can tell you my own personal experience, and it is real.
Uh-huh.
And I am convinced that people who would describe themselves as religious or spiritual have had that experience of, oh, wow. Of touching something that is absolutely transcendent.
Oh, well, I have nothing to say to them. I haven't had that experience. If I had that experience, I'd consult a psychotherapist. I merely want to point out, A, that is not sense perception. B, it is not rational.
In your epistemology, in your religion.
I do not have any religion. I'm an atheist. I oppose.
Isn't a religion a belief system?
No. Religion is a belief system based on faith in the supernatural. I have no faith. I only accept what I can prove, and I do not accept anything supernatural.
But you don't think that atoms have empty space in them?
That would be supernatural, wouldn't it? Because empty
well, I don't
space
know.
Would be empty space would be a where there is non-existence, where there is what is not. That would be a contradiction, and that's the.
But they have devices that are capable of measuring it.
Scientists are capable of measuring non-existence.
Sure, I mean, you look at a physics textbook.
I'm aware of. I've had a lot of debates on the plenum, which is the topic goes back to Greek philosophy, has nothing to do with religion.
The ether.
You may say my arguments are flawed, but I'm not saying, oh, I had an experience that there is no vacuum. Or that I have faith that there is no vacuum. I'm saying,
sure you are. Sure you're saying that.
Well, you could have fooled me.
Well, I mean,
what else
is
faith? Let's define our terms. What is faith?
Yeah, okay. Definition of it?
My definition is the commitment of your mind to ideas in the absence of evidence or against the evidence. It's believing what you don't have any reason to believe. If you have reason to believe in something, that's confidence. That's not the same as faith. Faith.
That's what? I'm sorry.
Confidence. Confidence.
Confidence. Okay. Submit to you, Harry, that most, the majority of the people that I've spoken with who would describe themselves as religious or spiritual have confidence rather than religion.
No rational basis for their views.
They have an experience.
Yeah, and all these loons have the experience that Allah or the Hellbop Comet or the heavenly...
Well, now we're getting
whatever.
Into a realm where we agree, and that is that when people then build institutions out of this stuff and then say this institution is the only right institution and this institution has the only way and we know all the answers, and by the way, if you don't go our way, look out Dover, Pennsylvania, we're going to come and get you. I agree with you on that there's some danger in that. But just the basic concept of spirituality, I can't get there. But good hearing from you, Harry. Harry Binswanger, the professor of philosophy, AYNRAND.org. Good talking with you, Harry. Thanks a lot for being with us today. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Whatever happened to the values of humanity? Whatever happened to the fairness and equality? Instead of spreading love, we're spreading animosity. Lack of understanding leading us away from unity.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. The place where tuning in is as easy as getting into the White House, getting a White House press pass if you happen to be a gay hooker. Welcome back to our program. What about religion? And what about spirituality? See, here's my take on this, and that is that spirituality is a basic instinctual thing. I think the Marvel's book, Why God Won't Go Away, this posits that this is an experience that a lot of people have, and they try to make meaning out of the experience, and that's where we end up with religions. And the religions very often screw things up, scramble them around. And then, to take it to the political where it gets even stranger, you have our tax laws and you have, churches engaging in politics. And, just very simply, well, for example, right now we've got a prominent liberal church, right? A liberal All Saints Episcopal Church in I believe it's in Los Angeles. The IRS going after them. Now, the Reverend George Regas gave a speech there, or a sermon, didn't mention that he was supporting President Bush or John Kerry, simply talked about peace. Seriously, this is from the Washington Post. Back a week or so ago, the church's rector, Edwin Bacon, told his congregation about the problem Sunday. He says, it's important for everyone to understand that the IRS concerns are not supported by the facts. He later said he chose Sunday to inform the congregation because Nobel Peace Prize winner Archbishop Desmond Tutu was in attendance and because he believes the decision from the IRS is imminent. Some All Saints members said they feared the 3,500-member church was being singled out for its political views. Now, this is pretty amazing. This guy gave an anti-war speech, not a pro-candidate speech, but basically a Jesus doesn't support wars sermon. And the IRS is going after them. At the same time, you got Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, out there doing their thing and doing it pretty aggressively in ways that, some people would say are fairly toxic. And nobody seems to be, the IRS certainly doesn't seem to be saying anything about them. I mean, Pat Robertson coming out and threatening an entire town with the wrath of God because they didn't vote his way. But he's allowed to run a $1 billion empire, tax-free. The deal that we made with churches way back when, pretty straightforward, from the IRS. Tax-exempt organizations, charitable, religious, educational, scientific, literary, testing for public safety, fostering national, international, amateur sports, and the prevention of cruelty to children and animals, right? Very, very straightforward stuff. And this, under the Internal Revenue Code, this is from the Department of Treasury, from their website. Under the Internal Revenue Code, all Section 501c3 organizations, that's nonprofits, are absolutely prohibited from directly or indirectly participating in or intervening in any political campaign on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate for elective political office. Now, that seems pretty unambiguous. Violations of this prohibition may result in denial or revocation of tax-exempt status. They're going to say contributions to political campaign funds or public statements of position written or verbal made on behalf of an organization in favor of or in opposition to any candidate for public office clearly violate the prohibition against political campaign activity. So what we've said is that there are some things that we think are like really important. It's really important to have schools. It's really important to have communities for abused kids. It's really important to have, you know, the local dog shelter and organizations that work to prevent the cruelty to animals. It's so important to have these things that we're going to give them the same exemption we give government, which we all collectively agree is fairly important. We do want to have, you know, our streets paved and our traffic signs working and police and fire and all that kind of stuff. We're going to give them tax-exempt status. They're not going to have to pay property taxes. They're not going to have to pay income taxes. And the only thing we ask from them, we're going to pick up the tab for your share of the commons. All we ask is that you don't involve yourself in politics. And I suppose you could argue that Falwell and Robertson, you know, when they get into their extensive rants, are really talking, are not talking politics, but I don't know.
And I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle.
Now, this was the day after 9/11.
The ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
That Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, of course, continued.
Well, I totally concur. And the problem is we have adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible as a free society for what the top people do. And the top people, of course, the court system.
Yeah, and now they've gone after the court system. And you tell me that's not political? Tell me Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson are not political. Jerry Falwell going on crossfire? I mean, it's just... Brrr. So at what point does religion become toxic? At what point is the religious impulse distorted or twisted by organized religion? At what point does that become illegal, or at least against the rules? At what point do we say to a church, you know, you can continue being a church and you can advocate for George Bush or John Kerry or whoever you want, but just don't ask us to pay for your fire department anymore. Start paying your own taxes. Is that too much to ask? 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You gave them the old, stay the course, I'm your man. Why, he'll flip-flop ya.
Oh, yes, you did, George.
He has no strength to lead, yes, this you feared. While soldiers' jobs and surplus disappeared. Gave them the old, devil, yeah, devil speak. Yes, with folks swindled them. No one could hear the truth above the roar. And though your debating was a stinker, they bought it all, hook, line, and sinker.
Oh, maybe.
You dazzled them, and they gave you four more.
Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
I hear there's rumors on the... Internets. You cannot lead if you send mixed messages.
Welcome back. It's just that is so great. Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-8466. When does religion become toxic? Or spirituality, change into religion? How do you know, what's the relationship between all of this stuff? Akvar in Flemington, New Jersey on the line. Hey, Akvar, welcome to the program. For some reason, I am not able to click on this thing. Hang on just a second here. Oh, okay. Akvar, welcome to the program. We're not here in Akvar. I'm sorry. Yeah, there you go. Akvar, now you're on with us. Akvar? Go ahead. Okay. Yeah, you guys have to release that and not lock it so that we can drop it and go to somebody else. Let's go to John in Lamar, Colorado. Hey, John, what's up?
How are you doing today?
Good.
All right. Well, I'm a right-wing Christian man, and I just wanted to speak with, you know, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. I think you're right on that. You know, they're speaking too much of their beliefs and getting people to do the, you know, to go to the right. So I agree with you there, but I also think we need to address, you know, like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, who do the same thing for the left. You know, I think we all, both sides have the church leaders who speak too much of political things. Politics needs to be out of the church. And again, the church just needs to tell people to vote their conscience.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all. I just have to say, I need to speak. I'm sorry, this is a terrible radio, but to Alex in New York, would you please ask whoever is trying to devirus this computer on the screen right now live? I can't see the screeners. I can't see what's going on. Ask them to get away from that computer and give it back to me, please. Thank you. I'm sorry, John. Okay. So, yeah, got it. I don't disagree with you at all. And good point. Thanks for the call.
Right.
Let's move on to Dave in Reno, Nevada. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi. Am I on?
Yeah, you are.
Okay, cool. Point I wanted to bring up is that this is just another example of Republican hypocrisy. If they were interested in getting politics out of the churches, they would have zapped the the Catholic Church last year when they were threatening to excommunicate anybody that voted for Kerry.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And the interesting thing is that excommunication threat originated with the guy who's now the Pope. By the way, he was the head of the Vatican office of, you know, whatever it's called now, that used to be the Inquisition.
Sent
the letters to the American bishops saying that anybody who supports freedom of choice with regard to abortion should not be given communion, and you know, which started the whole firestorm.
There's also the fact that anybody with any brains knows that the Catholic Church has been a political body for hundreds of years.
In large part, yeah, and well, and for that matter, I mean, you know, they ruled large chunks of Europe. the Catholic Church actually is a nation right now. They have a seat in the United Nations.
Isn't that where the Protestants came from, or it was the C of E came because the kings didn't feel like taking political advice from the church anymore.
Well, the Church of England came about because Henry VIII wanted to get divorced. I mean, that was the bottom line on that.
With church doctrine, but until then, they were controlling the politics of the entire European world.
Yeah,
you know, everything west of Turkey was controlled entirely by the Catholic Church.
Yeah, good point, Dave. Now, but back to the original point here, and that is that, you know, is there something inherently toxic in religion? I frankly think that it's possible to have a religion that's not toxic, and I think that if you go back and you look at the founders of each one of the world's great religions, by and large, what they were suggesting was a non-toxic form of spirituality that was, you know, where people could get together and hang out and you know, feel good, for lack of a better. I mean, you know, we don't have a lot of good words to describe the spiritual experience in our language. But, you know, where people could have that experience. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I mean, I must have been, this was like the first time that this happened to me. I must have been 6, 7, 8 years old, something like that. And we were out, it was a weekend, and we were visiting this older couple that owned a farm in Michigan on the summer, a beautiful summer day. And I'm sitting on the lawn in front of this farmhouse with this old guy who's been a farmer his whole life. And we're drinking lemonade. And we're looking out at a line of trees, and beyond that a cornfield, and beyond that a forest, and there's a little river that's running through it. And the sky is a deep, deep blue, and there's a few clouds in it. And he looks out at it all, and he says, look at all that out there. He says, look at the grass and the trees and the sky and the wind and the clouds and everything. And he just kind of goes through it all, and I'm looking at it. And he leans over and says, in this kind of conspiratorial whisper, like he's sharing a secret with me, he says, it's all alive. And there was just that moment when all of a sudden it just washed over me. Oh, my God, it's all alive. It really is. There's something here. I mean, there's just, it's a fire with life. And that for me, that I describe that as a religious experience. And I think that that's something that, is a relatively common thing for human beings. And we experience it in different ways. Richard in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Great. But I'll get back. What's up?
You know, I just wanted to let all of your listeners know that they can go to the website for All Saints Church in Pasadena, California. Just Google in All Saints in Pasadena. It comes up. You can go into their archives. The sermon was given on October 31st, 2004, and let people read it for themselves. It is a beautiful piece of Christian literature. It is exquisite.
Yeah. All Saints Church. Great. And the date again for that was?
October 31st, 2004. I think it was the Sunday probably right before Election Day. And, you know, it strikes me as rather odd that they're considered a liberal church, if you want to use that word, just because I attend an Episcopalian church here in Western North Carolina, and it's anything but liberal, and it's not particularly, I mean, they do have a little more leeway in terms of thinking about certain things they want, and this particular church does a lot with supporting AIDS patients and really some wonderful things. But this sermon was about the conversation Jesus would have with Senator Kerry and President Bush, and it just lays it right on the line. I mean, you know, the guy that was here 2,000 years ago, he was throwing out the money changers. He wasn't helping us. He wasn't giving them tax breaks. He was talking about feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and things along those lines.
Sure. Yeah, it's all there in Matthew 25 and in the Sermon on the Mount. Absolutely, Richard. And thank you very much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. And that's the point. I mean, I have a bumper sticker. It's not on my car, but somebody gave me a bumper sticker once that says, Jesus, the original liberal. And there you go. Akbar in Flemington, New Jersey. Let's try this again. Hey, Akbar, can you hear me this time?
Can you hear me this time?
I certainly can. What's up?
Okay, great. I wanted to say that, to me, the toxicity of religions begins when they start to tell everybody how to think and take away an individual's freedom to think for their own spirituality rather than by the dogma of whatever religion is.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, where it starts, because if you don't think like us, you can't be one of us.
Well, this is the weird nature of it. It's like, I think that some cults in particular, let's say, started with somebody had an experience, sort of like the experience I described. They had some experience that they interpreted as religious or insightful, and they decided that's an experience that they had that nobody else can have, that they have some secret knowledge or special knowledge, and therefore they've been selected, and therefore they're the ones who everybody has to follow. And so they go off to, you know, whatever, Salt Lake City with all their wives or whatever. Not to pick on the Mormons. I was
born and raised as a Catholic on the south side of Chicago. You're describing exactly the way the church at that time taught things. If you're not one of us, then you're not included. I was told that my three non-Catholic grandparents weren't going to get to heaven.
Yeah. And see, that's where religion steps over the line in my in my mind, just talking about religion. But talking politically, I think that there's this bigger issue of, have we not only allowed religion, you know, we're never going to be able to stop religion from being toxic in terms of its relationship to itself and to its parishioners and to other religions, but have we allowed religion to become toxic to the body politic and to America, to the whole concept of the United States of America? What would the founders say about this? I'll share some quotes from Thomas Jefferson and George Washington with you after this. And your calls, 866-440-THOM. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I was in the car and I heard this guy. He sounded all shook up and he told me why. His voice was a shame on the EIB. sounded like an Oxycontin eater to me.
Uh-oh.
It was a bug-eyed, tone-deaf, flying Oxycontin eater. Strung out hypocrite prescription cheater. Rush looked strange to me.
Yes.
His housekeeper picked up.
Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 866-440-8466. We're going to go to your calls in just a second. First, I just wanted to share with you the Thomas Jefferson, one of his most famous quotes, which is, if you go to the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., it's carved in the ceiling at the very top. It goes, you know, all in a circle all the way around the building. And just this piece of it, just this piece of the quote, he said, and what they have put up there, I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. And a lot of people, a lot of, you know, Falwell types quote Jefferson saying that. And as I said, just that piece of it, just that piece of the quote is in the Jefferson Memorial. Quote that is saying, you know, he was a, the founders were good Bible thumpers. Well, here's the letter where that quote comes from. This is from Jefferson to Benjamin Rush. This was 3 months before he was elected president of the United States in 1800. Yeah, dear sir, Benjamin Rush was a dear friend of his and a deist. He says, dear sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten. I do not know that it would reconcile the genus irritable vatum, which is Latin for the angry poet priests, who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened. The delusion on that clause of the Constitution, now he's talking about the First Amendment here, on that clause of the Constitution, which while it secured the freedom of the press, covered also the freedom of religion, has given to the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believes its own form to be the true one, everyone perhaps hopes for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. The returning sense, good sense of our country. Now, this, he's talking about his own election, right? The possibility of his own being elected. He says, the returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes. And they, the preachers, believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, but enough, too, in their opinion. End of quote. Thomas Jefferson. So, there you go. 1-866-440-THOM. Barbara in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Barbara, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you. On this issue, I believe that the Bush administration has blurred the line between the theological, the ideological, and with the conflicts that combined with everything else that the citizens are conflicted about, it has really set a very, very bad tone in this country, because what he believes is not what the entire country believes in terms
of religion. Yeah, although he tries to represent it as that.
Absolutely. And if you don't, again, you're either with us or against us, that kind of attitude.
Yeah. And it's absolutely tragic. Barbara, thank you for making an excellent point. This is from an email from Jerry Falwell to his flock. Every political conservative, every evangelical Christian, every pro-life Catholic, every traditional Jew, every Reagan Democrat, and everyone in between must get serious about reelecting President Bush. And this guy still has his tax-exempt status. Tell me what's wrong with this picture. Thurman in Omaha, Nebraska. Hey, Thurman, welcome to the program.
Hi, I've gotten into church and state arguments all the time, as you can imagine, being here sort of in the upper regions of the Bible Belt.
Yeah.
But I think what's also particularly instructive are Roger Williams's writings, the founder of Rhode Island and what's the university there in Providence?
Brown. Yes.
Brown University.
Yes, the early Puritan Roger Williams.
Right, right. And what he wrote was that forced religion is basically an insult to the face of God, and writing for freedom of religion for the colony.
Yeah,
you know? And if
that's,
you look, oh, go ahead.
No, go finish.
Oh, if you look at the founding fathers and you know who they really were, a lot of the most influential of them who put together the, as you well know, the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and Bill of Rights were actually Masons, and it was part of a long-running battle against the churches of Europe.
Yeah, and many of them were deists. For example, Ben Franklin, in his autobiography, Toward the Mystery, he writes, "I found Christian dogma unintelligible. Early in life, I absented myself from Christian assemblies." And so, yeah, there was a lot of conflict among the founders. Thurman, thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Scott in Richmond, Virginia. Scott, welcome to the program. We have about a minute left. What's up?
Thanks. Briefly, the argument about religion today is really just a political argument. That's
tragically,
it's a subterfuge, because what happened was liberals tried to push for inclusiveness and said we should remove religion from the market square, and Republicans took this as an affront to Christianity.
Right.
But really, it causes an alignment of Christians to the Republicans and everybody else to the Democrats, and it's just a political divisiveness.
Oh, yeah, and now you got Fox News out there, you know, hyping this thing of, is your retail stores talking about Christmas or holidays?
Right.
And it's like, you know, I'm sorry, I'm sufficiently solid in my faith that I'm not offended if somebody doesn't use the word Christmas, even though I define myself as a Christian. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. I mean, this is like, you know, where do you draw the lines? Well, clearly you draw the line. It's right there in the IRS code. If somebody is using religion to push politics, they're welcome to do that. They just can't claim tax-exempt status, unless they happen to be Jerry Falwell. Well, no, that's not in the IRS code. That's just in the policy of this government. Well, or unless they happen to be Reverend Moon, who's, you know, major supporter of the Bush administration, publisher of the Washington Times, etc. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Clarence Darrow: "The pursuit of truth will set you free, even if you never catch up with it." It's absolutely great. Speaking of the pursuit of truth, what is the truth about the biological, the biosphere, what's going on around us in the world? Dr. Neil Carman is with us. He's with the Genetic Engineering Committee at the Sierra Club. The website, www.stopgetrees.org. Dr. Carman, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to
what
be
is
here.
Thank you. Great to have you here. What is a GE tree?
Well, this is a new technology that uses gene splicing to make trees that are genetically engineered for example, increased pest resistance, or to make, a weaker wood so the trees can grow faster and be harvested more quickly. So there is a tremendous rush today to genetically engineer trees in nature for wood, paper, pulp, fruit, nut trees. In Hawaii, we already have a genetically engineered papaya to resist a virus that was actually devastating the papaya crops.
Now, you know, on the face of it, it would seem if you have a virus that's devastating the papaya crops and you can engineer a plant to resist the virus, what's wrong with that?
Well, on the surface, it sounds positive. However, there are hazards with this technology called genetic engineering. One of the issues is that this is a very imprecise, inaccurate, and unpredictable technology. So instead of doing all this, planting these trees on a commercial scale, we need to do a lot more short-term and long-term testing to make sure that we're not going to, for example, in Hawaii, there's already been contamination of organic papaya plantations out there. And so there's a lot of concerns. You could have genetic contamination of our native forests and wild places. You could also have, because some of these trees, genetically engineered trees, are being programmed to produce their own pesticides, you could have silent forests because of the high pesticide production. There would be no insects, no butterflies, no birds, no animals, no wildlife, because the trees would not be producing any seeds or edible food for the local food chain. So there's many hazards that are possible from genetically engineered trees.
Dr. Neil Carman with the Sierra Club's Genetic Engineering Committee. I assume you're familiar with the story that this was many years ago, 6-8 years ago. There was a woman who was working in one of the universities out west, and frankly, forgive me for not having this right in front of me, but maybe you'll recognize it. And there was a company that was developing a bacteria that would digest plant cellulose, convert it into ethanol. And wouldn't this be a great thing, right? It's because there's all this excess plant material that is routinely burned, you know, the wheat chaff and sugar cane and whatnot, that instead you could toss it into these giant bins, toss this bacteria in, it would digest the cellulose, produce ethanol, you could burn the ethanol. And they were preparing to release this into the environment to test it, outside on a few acres of land. And she, one of her grad students, was doing a study on this. And they discovered that when they inoculated many different kinds of plants with this, and this was a pretty ubiquitous bacteria, that it killed the plants because it converted some of the cellulose at the surface of their roots to alcohol, and the alcohol was toxic to the plants. And her conclusion was that if this bacteria actually got released, it could lead to the death of all plant life on Earth. And they stopped it. They stopped the experiment. But do you recall the names or any of the, you know what I'm talking about, this story?
Yes, I know who the researcher is, I think
I wish I could remember her name. I had her on this program a year ago.
that's the kind of hidden hazard that, you know, we need to be concerned about, because this is such a radical new technology. And so that's just one good example of what can go wrong. I mean, you know, back in the days when we were first tampering with, nuclear energy and releasing atomic weaponry into the atmosphere, it took us, by 1963 to realize that we had to have a global atmospheric test ban treaty, because we knew there were many hazards with, nuclear contamination.
And now, so
with these genetically engineered trees, once these trees are released into nature, unlike nuclear contamination or even toxic chemical spills, these trees will be, many of them will be reproducing, assuming they're not sterile, and they can escape from these genetically engineered tree plantations. Some of them will probably be weedy trees, because that's kind of how they're designed in some cases. So they could easily escape from these tree plantations and be growing wild.
And the downside, now, it seems to me that the biggest problem here is not so much the possibility of these trees escaping and the danger that they can do. I mean, that's a very real danger. But the biggest problem is the mindset that brings it about. Because if that's not corrected, then even if we stop this particular tree or that particular plant, there's just going to be more of this coming down the road. And the mindset is that nature is a giant machine, and if we can just figure out which levers to push and pull, everything will be fine. And the reality is that machines and living organisms are quite different. I can take my car apart, put it back together, and it still runs. I can't take a cow apart and put it back together and have it still moo.
Yes, I think that we're tampering with very complex organisms. For example, the pinyon pine species is known to have roughly 1,000 other species of insects and microorganisms and, you know, wildlife that are associated, you might say, with the ecosystem that the pinyon pine species dominates. And so, you know, if you tamper with one part of its genetics, you don't know what the repercussions or the impacts will be on the other 1,000 species. So
right, and even if you thought you did know, you wouldn't know, because ultimately it's just far. I mean, this is just an incredibly vast and extraordinary and complex system that interacts with everything else.
Yes, it's extremely complicated, and so right now there are hundreds of field trials that are going on in the United States alone and in other countries around the world, but it's happening in the U.S. They're not commercially approved by the federal government, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the EPA, but we still have all these field trials, and there is even a possibility of the pollen escaping and contaminating some local, you know, tree species.
So wait a second. There are experiments going on right now where
yes.
they're putting genetically engineered trees outdoors where the wind can pick up their pollen, because these trees do reproduce, you know, also most trees, many trees, and without any kind of an approval or oversight process?
Well, they go through a registration, but basically the whole regulatory framework is pretty much a sham. And so there are a lot of field trials going on in the United States. It's happening in Oregon, it's happening in Washington and California, it's happening on the East Coast. It's happening in a number of different states around the country, but there's a lot of it on the West Coast, and especially in Oregon. Where a number of researchers are working, and they've already got these trees developed. They're not commercially approved for, you know, growing genetically engineered tree plantations, but they've got the trees growing in field trials, and some of them have been grown outdoors, although supposedly they're not being allowed to reach the flowering stage. Trees, it takes usually a few years, 5 to 10 years before they undergo flowering and produce, you know, pollen and so forth that could be released and contaminate, you know, local trees.
We have about a minute left. Dr. Neil Carman with the Sierra Club, stopgetrees.org. What can people do about this?
Well, I think people need to become aware, and there's a new videotape on silent forests, and it's narrated by Dr. David Suzuki, who's an eminent Canadian geneticist.
He's been on this program several times.
Yes.
Good guy.
And so I think I would encourage people, they can obtain it by going to that website.
StopGETrees.org.
Yes, it's about a one-hour video. It's just been released, and it's very powerful, and I would encourage people to obtain a copy and watch it.
Yeah, okay, great. Stop GE, as in genetically engineered, StopGETrees.org.
Yes.
This is a serious threat, not just to our trees, not just to our forests. This is literally a threat to life on Earth.
Yes.
Would you? Yeah. It's this isn't just a nuclear reactor down the street that might make, you know, 1,000 square miles uninhabitable. We're talking about the planet here. Dr. Neil Carman, Genetic Engineering Committee of the Sierra Club. Thanks so much for being with us, Dr. Carman.
Thank you, Tom.
And be sure, check out this website, stopgetrees.org. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Speaking of sanity, Greg Gorman, one of the sanest people I know, doing something a lot of people would think is a little crazy, traveling off to Islamabad, Pakistan. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Tom. Well, thanks for the compliment. First of all, I appreciate you thinking that I'm sane. I am in an insane place, I can tell you. You know, nature has dealt this place a terrible blow. I've been here for 4 days, and this is my third day here in Islamabad. And actually, yesterday I went to Muzaffarabad, in Azad, Kashmir, the capital of the Pakistani part of Kashmir, and I saw the earthquake devastation firsthand, and I can tell you that it's just absolutely remarkable what's happened here.
Remarkable in what do you mean?
Well, there's a mountain above the city that looks like it's been chopped in two. It has broken apart from itself and fallen into the city. There are 2.3 million homeless people here. Now there are 85,000 confirmed dead, that number, according to people here on the ground, is probably closer to 250,000. You know, there are people who were just not tracked. And there are entire villages that are gone. The earth opened up and swallowed up, you know, entire families. In 4 weeks, it will be the Himalayan winter. It'll be freezing. There'll be snow on the ground, and people are living on the mountain in tents and in the city on the side of roads. President Musharraf is having a donor conference here in Islamabad. 300 world officials are coming, and he'll be asking for $5.2 billion.
That's an enormous amount of money. Do you think he'll get it?
It's an enormous amount of money, and, you know, and there's an enormous amount of need here. In Muzaffarabad yesterday, when we were driving around, it's been 42 days since the earthquake. There are still stones and rubble in the full, you know, on the ground in the road. People are living in tents on the side of the road. They're cooking out in the open. There's just no... In Muzaffarabad, there are 70% of the buildings are permanently damaged. Tomorrow, I'm going to a place called Bagh, and there, we've been told it's 99.9% of structures are permanently damaged. So it's going to be worse than what I've seen so far.
I'm wondering how this is playing in Islamabad, Greg. Are the, you know, for example, here in the United States, when the extent of the horrors of Hurricane Katrina became evident, and were broadcast nationally, at least for the first few days before the Bush administration went in and declared martial law, kicked all the media out of New Orleans and stopped the horrific pictures. Americans donated over $1 billion in total to charities ranging from Pat Robertson's charity, which was Operation Blessing, which was right up at the top of the FEMA website, to the Red Cross. How are the people of Pakistan responding to this?
Well, they're doing a lot. I mean, you know, the Pakistani military is actually coordinating all of the relief efforts. Everyone is taking their orders from the Pakistani military. We talked to some American soldiers yesterday. They are subordinate to the Pakistanis. I sat in on a few meetings today with local Pakistanis who live here, and everyone they know, they said, has given money. They said if you went up to anyone in Islamabad, they would say they had given money somehow.
Is the Red Crescent active there?
You know, I didn't see the Red Crescent as much as I expected to in Muzaffarabad yesterday. I know they're here because we've heard people talk about them. And, of course, here in Pakistan, if you would like to give money, you can do it through the Red Crescent. So, you know, they're here. The United Nations is here as well. And, of course, 60%, well, this is what we've heard here, 65% of the aid that's here on the ground and these sorties that are being dropped, flown, 190 tons of relief supplies are being dropped each day. 65% of that is coming from the United States. You know, there are 12 U.S. helicopters here. There are military here from the U.S., from Great Britain, from France, and, you know, from Germany, from Japan. So it's an international effort. A few people came up to me when I was in Muzaffarabad. They knew I was an American, and they said, thank you for what we're doing. So, you know, it's what people are hearing on the ground. They're grateful to have anything.
Yeah, I can imagine. As part of your trip there, are you participating in an effort to draw more contributions into the area, or are you just trying to let people know of what's going on? I mean, what provoked you to go there, and what's the call for action that you have? We have about a little more than a half a minute left, Greg.
Well, the Talk Radio News Service was invited here by an organization called ARC, Americans for the Resolution of Kashmir. They're an organization here on a humanitarian aid. They are trying to raise money to build some shelters. It takes about $1,000 for each shelter that holds between 8 and 10 people. And they're trying to raise money, as are other private organizations. And that's what we're doing here. We're just trying to get a picture of how bad it is and what it's like on the ground.
And is there a fundraising link at talkradionews.com, for example?
There isn't yet, but as soon as I get back to Washington, there will be one to ARC and to some other private organizations. It's ARC, ARK.org, and you can go to their website and get information.
Okay, great, great. And you'll be putting up pictures of your journey?
I am.
When you get back?
I am. I have a lot of pictures, and I'll be back in Washington next week, and I'd love to talk to you more about what we've seen and what we see tomorrow.
Great. Good talking with you, Greg. Greg Gorman, he's in Islamabad, Pakistan, with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I've been meek and hard like an oak. I've seen pretty people disappear like smoke. Friends will arrive, friends will disappear. If you want me, honey, baby, I'll be near.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour, or you could say coming up on 25 to the hour. Be 25 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A place where we run rings around the right wing every day, and try saying that four times fast. It's a bit of a challenge. Uh-oh. Uh-oh. There you go. Yes, it's time for a... Wow! Strange stuff going on alert. Sure enough, Clearwater, Florida, a Florida state senator wants to require convicted, drunken drivers... Thank you, sir. Wants to require convicted drunken drivers to have license plates that start with DUI. They're also proposing that these license plates be pink. Now, frankly, I have to say, I don't think that this is a bad idea. In fact, I think it's probably a good idea because for example, some friends of ours, our daughter and some of her friends were out driving in a car. The other night, and she and three other young women, and this cop followed them for an hour, and finally pulled them over and said, you didn't use your turn signal back there an hour ago, and you've been driving slow. And she was like, the driver was like, hey, we've been driving slow because you've been following us, and and he says, well, I thought maybe you were drunk or something, and probably it was just four attractive young women in a car, and he had an opportunity to go up and lecture them and whatever. Who knows? But no ticket or anything. But the bottom line is that I think that there are, whether it's police officers or whether it's, just all the rest of us driving in the road, driving on the highways, and you see somebody weaving around, and if they had a DUI pink license plate, I'd be more inclined, personally, just speaking for myself, I'd be more inclined to pick up the phone and dial 911 and say, I think we've got a drunk driver on the road, in front of me. If this guy's wandering all over the road, then, thinking, well, maybe somebody's just, dropped their sandwich in their lap or they're trying to adjust their radio or something. So, frankly, I'm not sure that this is a bad idea. But the problem is that they want, if this were to become national, the president of the United States would have to have a pink license plate that says DUI. He has one drunk driving conviction. The vice president of the United States would have to have a pink license plate that says DUI. Now, he has two drunk driving convictions. These, by the way, are this is the first president and the first vice president in history to have been convicted of a crime before they came to office. And, are we going to have that? This in Florida? Now, I doubt that Jeb has ever gotten a DUI like his brother George did, but he certainly got, his kids have some problems. So somehow I suspect this is just not going to make it through the legislature. Call me cynical or skeptical, but just don't think it's going to happen. Dick Cheney, by the way, fascinating new take on this whole thing, what's going on with Bob Woodward. Bob Woodward has now said, speaking of Cheney, Bob Woodward has now said that he knew before the Time Magazine, Matt Cooper from Time Magazine, before Judy Miller, before Bob Novak, he knew before any of them that Valerie Plame was a CIA agent, and he was told by somebody in the White House. Now, of course, Bob Woodward has to say that. I mean, that's just his job. He's Bob Woodward, and he's got to make sure that everybody knows that he knows everything, and he knows it before anybody else knows anything. But assuming actually that there's truth to this, although oddly, one of the folks that he says he told the story to says I don't have any recollection of that. But in any case, assuming that it's true, or is this just Woodward trying to drum up some PR? He's got a new deep throat. By the way, just a break in the stream of consciousness here for a moment. The folks in the chat room, Sue, in fact, tracked this down. I was talking about the bacteria that almost ate the planet. Remember in the last segment or two, 15, almost 30 minutes ago now, we were talking with a fellow from StopGETrees.org. The bacteria is called Klebsiella planticola, and the person who discovered it, who discovered that they were genetically modifying it in a way that might end all life on Earth and stopped it, is Dr. Lane Ingham of Oregon State University. So, and as I mentioned, she was on our program here about a year ago talking about that. And thank you, Sue, for that. Fascinating stuff. Anyhow, back to Bob Woodward. Bob Woodward says, you know, he's got a source. So now the denials are all coming out, right? He says, first of all, Bob Woodward says, it's not Scooter Libby. In other words, I've got a better source than Scooter Libby. Well, of course. And this goes back to, you know, when he was writing one of his two glowing, loving books about George Bush and his administration. Bob Woodward, this is a guy who knows which side his bread is buttered on. Let's just leave it at that. But anyhow, the White House has officially denied that George W. Bush was the source. They have denied that Andrew Card was the source. And they have denied that Dan Bartlett was the source. You know, at different times, they've asked about different people. Karl Rove denies that he was the source for Bob Woodward. Colin Powell has denied that he's the source. Now, Stephen Hadley, to the best of my knowledge, has not denied it or not denied it. Raw Story is saying that they think it's Stephen Hadley, maybe. But here's where it gets interesting. Former CIA Director George Tenet denies that he's the source. And Tenet's Deputy Director John McLaughlin denies that he's the source. But when they were asked if Cheney was the source, the answer was no comment. No comment. It's in today's New York Times. You can check it out. No comment. And as they point out over at thinkprogress.org, Cheney is, you know, lashing out now at the those people who want to rewrite history. They're terrible. We all saw him snarling on TV or heard him snarling on the radio because it got enormous coverage all over the place. And they point out, beyond the numerous and well-documented falsehoods, well, that's a nice, polite way of saying lies, that Vice President Cheney told in the lead-up to the Iraq War, there's another important reason why Cheney's recent attack on the opposition is incredibly disingenuous. Cheney was intimately knowledgeable about the danger to national and international security that would result from an occupation of Iraq. But he callously disregarded these concerns in the lead-up to war. Thus writes Faiz in the thinkprogress.blog. In 1992, he laid this out. Now, here's a BBC interview with Dick Cheney. This is Dick Cheney in Dick Cheney's words. Quote, he's talking about, this is right after the Gulf War in 91. You know, when George Bush Sr. pushed Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, but didn't go to Baghdad. Dick Cheney, quote, if we'd gone to Baghdad and got rid of Saddam Hussein, assuming we could have found him, we'd have had to put a lot of forces in and run him to ground someplace. Then you got to put a new government in his place, and then you're faced with the question of what kind of government are you going to establish in Iraq? Is it going to be a Kurdish government or a Shia government or a Sunni government? How many forces are you going to have to leave there to keep it propped up? How many casualties are you going to take throughout the course of this operation? This Dick Cheney, quoted in the New York Times on December 16th, 2003. But he was actually speaking in 1992. And then they point out, none of these questions have been answered. 2.5 years of occupation. We had a successful invasion. 2.5 years of occupation. We now have 2,079 dead American soldiers. Now, if it keeps going at this rate, sometime in the, you know, first half of next year, we're going to have more American soldiers dead in Iraq than people who died in 9/11. And I go out of my way not to juxtapose the two. But the Bush administration, you know, they're all the time trying to imply that Iraq, the invasion of Iraq had something to do with 9/11. Obviously, it had nothing to do with the attacks of 9/11. Cheney running around trying to peddle this stuff. But, I mean, the irony of that is Well, it's tragic, frankly. 15,500 American soldiers wounded, not to mention post-traumatic stress disorder, psychological wounds, $250 billion in American treasure, as it were. You know, look at what we have lost in this. I mean, this is just, it's I think for many people, it's absolutely overwhelming when you look at what this war has cost us. Where have we gone? How much have we lost as a result? So far, the war in Iraq has cost us $226,351,000. What could we have done with that? With that amount of money? Well, for example, we could have provided full four-year scholarships at public universities, a full 4 years at state schools, to college for 10,672,212 students in the United States. Do you think that having 10,672,213 students, 214 now, the counter is ticking along, students, 10 million students having full 672,215 now, having full four-year scholarships to public schools would have helped the United States more than invading Iraq? Somehow I suspect it might be the case. You know, we could have hired 3,815,165 additional public school teachers for a year. Do you think that having an additional 3,815,000 teachers in America would help the United States? Somehow I think so. Might be a good thing. We could have put 29,158,000 kids through a year of Head Start. Instead, we had to have Bush's war. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm telling you, the storm is coming in 2006. You want to see a storm? Wait till you see the voters of America. They are getting really upset with what's going on here. People who don't carefully pay attention to politics, they just have this sense something is terribly wrong in this country. Speaking of Vice President Dick Cheney, or Vice Resident Dick Cheney. Vice President Dick Cheney and his staff have declared themselves exempt from the travel disclosure laws followed by the rest of the White House. This is from the Center for Public Integrity. This is incredible. The Vice President's office appears to have stuck taxpayers with millions of dollars in travel costs and has avoided disclosing its expenses and destinations. Since 2001, Cheney's office, unlike Vice President Al Gore before him, has claimed that he is not bound by the travel disclosure rules the rest of the White House complies with. No, he's the boss. He's in charge. He doesn't have, letters in the vice president's counsel assert that the office is not an agency of the executive branch. I'm not kidding you. You read the whole report at publicintegrity.org. It said for the last 4 years, Dick Cheney has been saying that the vice president's office is, quote, not an agency, end quote, of the executive branch. In other words, he's not part of the executive branch of government. So he doesn't have to disclose where he travels or how much it costs the taxpayers. And as the Center for Public Integrity says, the vice president's office appears to have stuck taxpayers with millions of dollars in travel costs and has avoided disclosing its expenses. I mean, how much more brazen can you get? This is, you know, absolutely mind-boggling. It's incredible, man. And now we see this. Larissa Alexandrova of Raw Story laid this out. And it's actually, this is a good story. combined figures of those detained in both Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001, over 70,000 people. Now we're back to the four bombers in Jordan, right? One of them, the woman who was, who, you know, I mean, we know her story the best because she's the one who survived. And, you know, there actually may be a little bit of human interest here, but I doubt it'll ever get told. You know, why did she survive? Did her belt malfunction? Did her husband design it to intentionally malfunction? Was he trying to, you know, he didn't want her to die? Who knows? I mean, you know, you could make a movie out of it. Who knows? But anything that would make them seem like, real human beings is not going to happen. But she, apparently, if the news reports are accurate, three of her brothers died in the U.S. assault on Fallujah, where now the Pentagon is confirming that we dropped white phosphorus on the city. These are firebombs. And we know that another of the three guys who did blow themselves up in Amman, Jordan, I mean, all four of them were from Iraq. Iraq had never produced suicide bombers before we showed up. Of the other three, we know that at least one of them had actually been in U.S. custody and then was released. And the point that they're making over at Raw Story is that we are driving the insurgency by humiliating and angering and terrifying people by arresting them and then releasing them and treating them badly while they're arrested. And, I mean, there's just a certain amount of sense to this, right? A significant proportion of those who have been detained and subjected to abuse are joining the insurgency upon their release. A year after the invasion, according to official U.S. figures, the average number of insurgent attacks on coalition and Iraqi forces was less than 200 per week. That was a year and a half ago. Now, over 550 a week. That's more than doubled. The average number of civilian casualties per day, highest figure ever, 60 a day. 60 Iraqis dying a day. As more and more Iraqis have been detained and released, the insurgency has intensified. The number detained has more than doubled in the last year and a half. The number of attacks has doubled over the same period. Evidence suggests the current system of abusive detentions is a significant factor. That and, you know, as you see with this woman in Jordan, you know, lost three of her brothers in Fallujah. Well, we don't know how she lost them. Did white phosphorus come out of the sky and burn them to death? I mean, we just don't know. The Pentagon officials say white phosphorus was used as a weapon against insurgent strongholds during the Battle of Fallujah last November, but deny that it was used against civilians. Well, I'm sorry, Fallujah is a city. It's not, I mean, this is not like Runnymede, you know, and the where the, you know, King John in 1215, met the feudal lords, you know, on a battlefield, on a historic battlefield. No, this is a city. The 1980 Protocol 3 of the 1980 Convention on Conventional Weapons specifically says that white phosphorus cannot be used as an incendiary weapon against civilian populations or in air attacks against military forces in civilian areas. That's otherwise known as cities. But, you know, that was during Reagan, when Reagan was president. Reagan chose not to sign that treaty. So although Britain signed the treaty in the 1980 convention, which had to be ratified in 1981 when Reagan took office, the United States has not. So technically we haven't broken the law. We've merely infuriated the entire world. We have merely humiliated ourselves before the entire world. Say, no, we don't hold the standards of decency. I mean, the phosphorus itself causes painful burns. The smoke from it damages the liver, the heart, and the kidneys, and they drop this stuff on a city? Well, they're actually bragging about it in the March-April 2005 edition of the Army's Field Artillery magazine. We fired shake-and-bake missions at the insurgents using white phosphorus to flush them out and high explosives to take them out. From the air, where you can definitely tell that that person running across the street is not a civilian in a city of 250,000. And now you wonder why this woman's blowing herself up. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Wow. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Talk radio for the entire whole big bunch of us. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman, exposing the con in conservatives. Speaking of cons and neocons, Dick Cheney, one of the signers of the Project for New American Century's letter to Bill Clinton back in 1998 saying, attack Iraq now. Yeah, brilliant idea. Brilliant idea. One of the signers of that letter, Dick Cheney, our vice president, who, as we talked about in the last hour, has told us, no, he doesn't need to tell us. None of our business what his travel expenses are, even though we're paying for them, because he's not part of the executive branch of government. And so he's not beholden to the same disclosure rules. Back when he was given basically two responsibilities when Bush and Cheney came into power in 2001 as a consequence of a Supreme Court decision, five members of the Supreme Court, by and large, picked by either his daddy or by Reagan, said, yeah, sure, let's make George president and Dick vice president. And he comes into office and he's given two responsibilities by George W. One is to develop an energy policy for the United States. The other is to lead a task force to develop an energy policy for the United States. And the other is to lead a task force on counterterrorism to prevent the United States from being attacked. Because George Bush was told by Bill Clinton, and Dick Cheney was told by Al Gore, and Condi Rice was told by Sandy Berger as the transition of power was happening. All three of them were told in absolutely unequivocal terms, your number one priority has to be Osama bin Laden because he is coming after us. And we have to stop him. And we have already stopped him several times. We've stopped several plots. We've killed a bunch of his people. We've tried to assassinate him on several occasions unsuccessfully. This has to be your top priority. Well, Dick Cheney was given responsibility for that. He was put in charge of the counterterrorism task force, along with Condoleezza Rice, who was the national security advisor. And, of course, nothing happened. And except for 9/11, of course. Dick Cheney's counterterrorism task force never met before September of 2001. Never met. But his energy task force sure did meet. Who were they meeting with? Well, we don't know. And when the Sierra Club and other organizations sued, including conservative organizations, judicialwatch.org, Larry Klayman's organization, the right-wing group that originally did the lawsuit that led to the discovery of Bill and Monica's affair. They sued the vice president's office and said, we pay our taxes. We pay you work for us, buddy. Tell us who you were meeting with on our behalf. And Cheney took it all the way to the Supreme Court. Fought all the way to the Supreme Court to keep secret who he met with. And everybody speculated that it was oil industry executives. And then the oil industry executives all, come before Congress, and they're not put under oath, you'll recall. Big debate about this. Shall we put them under oath? No, let's not put them under oath. Ted Stevens, the notable and oil-drenched senator from Alaska, speaking with Maria Cantwell, the Democratic senator from the state of Washington, and Barbara Boxer, the Democratic senator from the state of California, and, in my opinion, good candidate for president of the United States. Here's the exchange. Ted Stevens saying, no, we're not going to put these guys under oath. We're not going to swear them under oath. If they lie to us, we wouldn't want it to be a crime. After all, we're Republicans, and they're oil industry executives. Or something like that. I mean, I'll let you make your own interpretation. Here's the clip.
I shall not administer an oath today, and we look forward to questions. Senator Cantwell?
Mr. Chairman, I did send you a letter co-signed by eight of my colleagues and asking that the witnesses be sworn in. This rare joint hearing...
I did not yield to make a statement. We're ready to go. We have a statement process.
Mr. Chairman, I would like the committee to vote on whether We swear.
There will be no vote. That's not in order at all. It's not part of the rules that any vote can be taken to administer an oath. It's the decision of the chairman, and I have made that decision.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we swear in.
That's Cantwell.
The witnesses.
And I rule that out of order.
I second the motion.
And that's Boxer.
Thank you very much. That's the last we're going to hear about that because it's out of order.
Mr. Chairman.
This is Barbara Boxer.
Can I just ask just for a little clarification here? If the senator makes this request and there's a second, why wouldn't we have a vote on that?
Because you can't vote to put in the rules something's not there. This is not a business meeting. There's no way to put this into the rules. This is a matter for the chairman to decide, and I've made the decision.
So the oil industry executives never got sworn in. No, siree. We can't have that. And when they were asked by Frank Lautenberg, a Democrat from New Jersey, they were asked if they were part of Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force meeting or if their companies were participating in this task force meeting. This task force, of course, that recommended $14 billion in welfare for the oil industry and the gas and coal and nuclear industry. Three of them said no. One of them said, I don't think so. And one of them said, I don't know. The meetings, after all, were held in secret. The White House refused to release a list of participants. As I said, you know, it took this all the way to the Supreme Court. So now we have people coming forward and saying, well, you know, if you look at the logs, the Secret Service logs, for who was in the White House when, the Secret Service logs of who's going in and out of the White House show that at least several of these guys or the representatives of their companies were in fact going into the White House and apparently meeting with Dick Cheney or his Energy Task Force as the legislation was being drawn up to give them billions of dollars in tax cuts. And grants and freebies and welfare. So Senator Lautenberg, a little incensed, he wants to bring these guys back before them. But Dick Cheney will have none of that. In fact, he's going on the attack. Last night you saw the speech, or heard the speech. Dick Cheney, it's these Democrats, they're dishonest and reprehensible. Presumably he's also speaking of Chuck Hagel and John McCain and several other Republicans. It was pretty amazing. And the American Progress Action Fund put together a really good analysis of this. The quote, again, from Dick Cheney. The suggestion that's been made by some U.S. senators that the President of the United States or any member of this administration purposely misled the American people on pre-war intelligence is one of the most dishonest and reprehensible charges ever aired in this city. Right. Let me just say it right straight up. And I'm going to back it up. Cheney and Bush lied to us. Purposely. And it's just, there you go. I mean, White House senior advisor Dan Bartlett added that the administration's critics have crossed a bright line by claiming that the Bush administration misled Americans into war because they have no facts on their side. Well, let's look at them. On September 8th, 2002, Dick Cheney said, and I quote, it is now public that, in fact, speaking of Saddam Hussein, he has been Sikhs on their side. Well, let's look at them. On September 8th, 2002, Dick Cheney said, and I quote, it is now public that, in fact, he has been seeking to acquire, and we have been able to intercept and prevent him from acquiring through this particular channel the kinds of aluminum tubes that are necessary to build a centrifuge. We do know with absolute certainty, said Dick Cheney, that Saddam Hussein is using his procurement system to acquire the equipment he needs in order to enrich uranium to build a nuclear weapon. At the time, the Department of Energy, the nation's foremost nuclear weapons experts, and the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research did not believe the aluminum tubes were for centrifuges to make nuclear weapons. And they were on the record. The Department of Energy and the State Department saying, no, sorry. Cheney saying, yes, it is. And, of course, after the invasion, any evidence of hidden centrifuge? Department of Energy and the State Department saying, no, sorry. Cheney saying, yes, it is. And, of course, after the invasion, any evidence of hidden centrifuges? No. Any evidence of a revived nuclear weapons program? No. Where were the aluminum tubes? They were over in that warehouse where they were building rockets, which is exactly what everybody... Scott Ritter came on this program back at the time. Mohammed Atta did go to Prague and did meet with a senior official of the Iraqi intelligence service in Czechoslovakia last April, several months before the attack. Turns out the CIA has publicly stated that they... Which meaning wasn't possible. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. The hour. Bionics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com. Get all the latest iPods and all other things Macintosh. Give them a call. Tell them we said hi. Dr. Sky Leininger is with us. He's the president and CEO of Health Notes. Is that healthnotes.com, Sky?
Well, it's really Health Notes inside of stores. So when people go to their local health food store or pharmacy or grocery store, we provide the information that people can get right in the store.
There you go. And in fact, some online sites as well. I know vitaminshop.com uses your product.
Yes, we're on. We're the leading provider, so a lot of the natural foods and grocery stores use our information. So you can go to any of the Kroger websites or Safeway or Vitamin Shop or GNC or, good examples, Wild Oats also.
And you're also the author of a book about natural remedies.
Yes, there's two books we have, actually. One's called The Natural Pharmacy, which talks about how to use natural remedies for really almost any health concern that you can think of, exactly how much of the vitamin or herb to take. And the unique thing is it's all backed up by science, so you really get a good idea of what to use. And then the second book is called The A to Z Guide to Vitamin-Herb-Drug Interactions, which is really the way to find out, should I be taking these things together? Is
right.
It safe? Or in many cases, you find out that the medications deplete various minerals or vitamins. And you should be taking extra things along with your medicine in order to keep yourself as healthy as possible.
Right. So some drugs you actually need a little extra calcium with, and on the other hand, you wouldn't want to take ginkgo biloba if you were taking a blood thinner, for example.
Exactly. Yeah, there's some that are safe, and there's some that are not safe. The funny thing is, we began to do the research on it, Tom, as we found that there were really more that they worked together well, as opposed to where they were dangerous taking them together. But you need to look and talk to your doctor, pharmacist, or at least read the information so that you're well informed.
Great, Sky. The reason that I wanted to have you on, you are clearly one of the leading experts in the United States about natural remedies. And part of that is that you understand as well the medical end of it. You know, you've got this one book that compares pharmaceutical drugs and natural things and how they can interact. Natural remedies for all sorts of things. And here we are, cold season, flu season. Louise is home in bed with a cold right now.
Oh,
as we
I'm
speak.
Sorry.
Yeah. And so I'm just, you know, what actually works, and what is hustle that people can safely ignore out there in the world when you go into a drugstore or a health food store, and then the follow up question will be, you know, what foods should people be eating or avoiding to help them avoid or get over a cold, for example, or the flu.
Great questions. And most people get flu and colds and sore throats kind of all mixed up in the same bucket. And then if you've got children, the other thing that you're, of course, going to be very worried about or you're going to be seeing a lot of are these ear infections. Because once you get a cold, then with the small children, that goes right into the ear. So I'm going to talk about that one first because there's something that's there that people won't know about, I think.
Okay.
And that's something called xylitol, and it's spelled with an X. It's
X-Y-L-I-T-O-L.
Exactly.
It's
and
a sugar.
Where you're going to find xylitol is going to be in chewing gum.
It's
a natural sweetener, but there's a lot of chewing gum that you can get in the grocery or health food store that has xylitol sweetener in it. You look for that, and they found that naturally occurring sugar, xylitol, keeps down some of the bacteria in the mouth. So it was originally used as something that would help prevent cavities. But they found that some of these same bacteria that are in the mouth are also the ones that go into the ear. And so if you're chewing xylitol, children who are prone to ear infections will end up with a reduced risk of getting those ear infections.
Oh, that's interesting. I know my dentist in Vermont before I moved out here was just fanatic about xylitol. I've got xylitol toothpaste. It's 35% xylitol. There's xylitol in some of the Tom's Natural mouthwashes.
Uh-huh.
Because apparently the bacteria, what is it, Streptococcus mutans in the mouth? Is that the bacteria that causes tooth decay?
There's a number of them that cause tooth decay, and also some of them that, of course, lead to halitosis or bad breath.
They chew up the xylitol, and it basically nukes them. We've got about a minute left, Sky. The common cold and the sore throat.
So the common cold and the sore throat, the things that you know about are vitamin C. And in both cases, they help reduce the likelihood of getting them, and they also reduce the length of time you're going to have them. The other thing to think about with the common cold and sore throat is really zinc in the form of a lozenge.
Where you suck on it, so it gets in slowly and it gets up into the tissues of your head.
You want to make sure you're getting the right kind of zinc. Zinc gluconate is what you want to look for.
Okay, zinc gluconate. As opposed to zinc oxide. I see zinc oxide all over the place.
Exactly. And you'll find that, but if you look on the back of the label, you just want to make sure you're getting zinc gluconate, because that's the one in the studies, and there's been a lot of studies that have shown this, double-blinded trials, that it reduces the length of the duration of the cold, and it also will help fight those, it'll help boost the immunity of the whole system so that it makes...
What about the herb echinacea, Sky?
Echinacea is another one of the ones that will help reduce the longevity and also reduce the likelihood of getting it in the first place. So
great.
I think if you're looking for an armamentarium, vitamin C, zinc, echinacea.
Cool. Okay. Dr. Sky Leininger, thank you so much for being with us, Sky.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking to you today. It's 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartmann radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, hang on to your dreams. There you go, 34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, 26 minutes before, coming up on 25 minutes before the top of the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. On the True People's Radio. Boy, a lot of the news. This mining law. I got to tell you about this mining law. It's absolutely incredible. I know, however, that Tom in Minneapolis wants to wrap up this discussion about Dick Cheney and lying. And, Tom, you always have special insights into things. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, just to expand a little bit on this. It's obvious that Bush and their minions, their best defense is a superior offense by just...
Always has been, by the way.
Oh, yeah. And they're just completely blanketing and carpet bombing the airwaves with even more lies and denials of their earlier lies.
Right.
So the only way that we can counter this strategy is for all the Democrats to equally blanket airwaves with simple one-word answers. And no matter what the question is, you just answer by slowly spelling out the word lie, L-I-E. No matter what they ask you, just say L-I-E. And that would get headlines because they'd be acting kind of weird and patronizing, but it would focus back attention on that they are the liars. They're trying to redirect and make it now that the Democrats are the liars.
Right.
And we just have to, in unison.
Wouldn't you just love to see Harry Reid out there going, liar, liar, pants on fire?
No, actually, yeah, just spell out the word like Al Franken would do, right? And, yeah, because... It looks like the Democrats are sitting back and letting these guys dominate the airwaves by calling the pot calling the kettle black, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know, I just wanted to say that we have to take back the offensive and even blanket even more the airwaves than them.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tom. Yeah. Good point, as always. Sherry in Linwood, Washington. Welcome to the program, Sherry.
Yes. Is that off enough now? I don't know how to see. Is my radio off
I don't know,
enough?
But you're on the air right now, Sherry.
Okay, you can hear me then. Okay.
I can hear you.
I have only one question.
Okay.
First, I'd like to...
Don't listen to your radio. Just listen to the telephone.
Okay. I'd like to suggest that it's possible, since those guys, speaking of the crime family, and Cheney, etc., have no intention whatsoever. For instance, if somebody else, if the Democrats get in 2008, they would all be facing a possibility of lots of trouble. All that they have no intention, they don't worry about anything because they have no intention of losing in 2008. They will continue, they will use the machines again, and they will win with Jeb having run, and they will be safe because they can't dare.
Well, it could be, or it could be that George W. Bush will do the same thing that Gerry Ford did with Richard Nixon, or that George Bush's father did with the conspirators who participated in what is euphemistically referred to as Iran-Contra, but really started back in 1980 with the deal,
right,
that they cut with the Ayatollah to hang on to the U.S. hostages so that the Reagan-Bush team could beat Jimmy Carter. And what he did so as to prevent any further investigation into these people was he pardoned them all. There was a half a dozen pardons of Iran-Contra figures as Bush Sr. was walking out the door so that those people could not be prosecuted. And so we would never find out because there would never be an inquiry in court of law. And when George Bush was asked last week, you know, will you pledge not to pardon Scooter Libby? He didn't take the question.
No, he wouldn't do it. But what about himself? What about he and Cheney himself? Both of them could be prosecuted upon by other countries, even.
Well,
there are countries that are talking about bringing him to court.
But this government is never going to extradite a former president. It's just never going to happen. I really think that if you think that the main reason why they would try to hijack the 08 elections is simply to protect their own butts, frankly, I think that they have stronger legal defenses than remaining in power.
Okay,
I think that
a
stronger argument for what you're saying, Sherry, is that they want to stay in power simply because they want to stay in power. They want to continue to have access to all that money and all those goodies and everything else.
Yes, I go with that. So they have no intention of leaving the power. They have no intention of losing in 2008, and nobody will do anything about it.
Well, I think that there's a lot of us who are trying to do something about it, and the pressure is building to do something about it. And I think the pressure is building to do something about it. And if the elections in 2006 are looking as weird as some of the ones just did in 2004, and there's more and more of us out here making noise about it, then I don't think they'll be able to get away with it in 2008.
Because nobody in Congress will even discuss it with Kerry. Did you hear what John Kerry said?
He didn't say nobody in Congress would. He said Chris Dodd wouldn't discuss it with him. Yeah, I had Mark Crispin Miller here. In fact, he was in the studio with us last week.
Yes, I know. I wanted to hear it, darn it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was good. And he told the story about how he said, you know, Senator Kerry, the election was stolen. And Kerry says, I know. And I tried to tell Chris Dodd and he wouldn't hear of it.
Right.
But now he won't go on the record and talk about it because he doesn't want to sound like A, a crackpot, or B, a sore loser. And that's immediately how Fox News would portray him if he were to say a single word about this. And frankly, I think, you know, if John Kerry's listening or anybody affiliated with him, John, come out and speak your concerns because the future of the republic is hanging in the balance. Sherry, thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you, and I appreciate it. Dale is that Mukilteo? Say it. Pronounce it for me, Dale, in Washington State there.
Mukilteo. It means good campground in some obscure Indian language of a people we decimated a long time ago.
Mukilteo. Okay, great. Well, you learn a new city every day. So what's up?
I was just thinking of listening to about the scorched earth policy of the Republicans accusing the Democrats of lying over the reasons for going to war.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurs to me that it's exactly that it's been there. Program since Gingrich's revolution in 94, whenever they see a weakness in their own party, their first response is to accuse the other side of being worse about it. And the first
right.
thing that comes to mind is affirmative action, which is that their argument is that it's the liberal elite's way of feeling superior to other races or cultures or whatever. And like I told a friend of mine, I know people that use the N-word all the time, and they don't vote Democratic. So are they confused?
Yeah.
You know, when
the hypocrisy of Republicans on affirmative action is breathtaking.
It is, but
it's just absolutely breathtaking.
Another example of everything else that they do. Every time you see them raise an argument about how evil the Democrats are, really turn it around.
Yeah, but on the other hand, though, Dale, I think that if we were to if we were to try and portray all Republicans as racists, you know, speaking of your friends, a few of your friends, then I think that we do ourselves a disservice because all Republicans are not racist.
And I agree with that completely. But I would take issue with Republicans trying to turn the argument around. I mean, there aren't. You're right. It's a very fine line between turning into exactly what I'm accusing them of. But the truth is that when they see their side being, they see a weakness in their side, their first response is, we must accuse the other side of this in some really horrific way.
You're absolutely right, and it's a good point, and it's a good meme to put out there, and I appreciate that, Dale. And with regard to, and thank you for calling, with regard to affirmative action, I think that the interesting thing about the Republicans and the Republican Party is that underneath it all, there is this kind of libertarian or Ayn Rand or whatever, you know, philosophy that the government really just shouldn't be involved in the marketplace. And if the marketplace is bigoted, if society is bigoted, tough, you know, or you know, in their utopian ideal, eventually that'll clean itself up. The marketplace will clean itself up. The marketplace of ideas, the marketplace, you know, quack, quack, quack. And that's the underlying philosophy. But the practical, but they don't, you know, they're not willing to say that out loud, because that would require them to admit that racism still exists. And so they try to pretend that racism doesn't exist. But in fact, they know that it does. And here's the real issue for them, and it's a very practical one. This is just the pure politics of it. Because racism still exists, and because affirmative action is necessary to correct some of the imbalances that are there as a consequence of racism. You know, the old, you can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps if you don't have bootstraps. Because of that, the Democrats find a larger constituency among African Americans and other minorities, by and large, than the Republicans do. And so the Republican attack on affirmative action is, as much as anything else, an attack on, you know, trying to diminish a Democratic constituency, trying to maintain them in an impoverished state, trying to maintain them in a state of, you know, where they wouldn't have access to voting. You know, these Jim Crow laws that they're passing, you know, down in Florida and whatnot, and Georgia, state of Georgia now, you've got to get a state-issued ID if you're going to vote. And, you know, a lot of poor people don't have state issues IDs, can't afford it, all that kind of thing. So that's the rant. TJ in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, TJ, we got about a minute left. What's up?
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. I think the Republican Party should run a commercial saying, with Hillary Clinton at the podium, pounding her fist on the podium, saying that Saddam Hussein needed to be removed from power, that he was a threat.
Oh, I'm sure they will, TJ. I'm sure they will.
Well, they should. And at the bottom of that, write the word L-I-E.
Yeah, sure, that she believed the lie, too. There's all kinds of people who believed that lie. Hillary Clinton was among them.
Don't forget about 9/11, the plane that went down in Somerset, the SSS Cole.
Had what to do with Saddam Hussein, please?
Saddam Hussein.
TJ, what did any of that have to do with Saddam Hussein?
Excuse me?
What did any of that have to do with Saddam Hussein?
You know something, sir? We sent a message. If anybody messes with our brothers and sisters of the United States, we're coming out.
Oh, so we sent the message that if you attack us at Pearl Harbor, we're going to bomb Brazil?
We sent the message. Anybody messes with the U.S., this is what's going to happen to you.
No, no, we sent a pathetic message, TJ. TJ, if you come over to my house and try and beat me up, and I can't take a shotgun and blow away my neighbor, what kind of message have I sent? That I'm crazy?
Oh, come on, Saddam Hussein, you guys are liberals or too much. Okay, thank you, sir.
You're welcome, TJ. Thanks a lot. You make my point as well as I can. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So a new man in the White House with a familiar name said he had some fresh ideas, but it's worse now since he came from Texas to Washington.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Now, I'm trying to figure out TJ's logic. I thought that was really great of you, TJ, to call in. I wish more cons would call the program because... you know, it makes for interesting conversation, and it's always interesting to get an insight into how somebody else's mind works. But aside from the idea that if one country attacks us, that we should attack a different country, That, you know, I still don't get that. But the part about Hillary, this is fascinating. We should run a TV commercial. The Republicans should run a TV commercial that shows Hillary Clinton saying, as she did, that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction and therefore we should go after him, and then put lie underneath it. Does that mean that it was a lie? And if she's telling the lie, does that mean that she was part of the Bush-Cheney conspiracy to lie? Or does that mean that she was the victim of the Bush-Cheney conspiracy to lie? I'm just, you know, I'm just curious how Bush might put this together. Jackie in Port Townsend, Washington. Hey, Jackie, welcome to the program.
Hi, I just had a question.
Sure.
If President Bush got impeached, would he still be able to pardon the criminals?
I don't know. Frankly, I'm not a constitutional lawyer or, you know, expert on that. It would be a question to put to John Dean, for example. What I do know is that if President Bush were impeached, then Dick Cheney would become president, and the odds are that Dick Cheney would pardon everybody on the way out.
Well,
so,
impeach the whole bunch of them?
I think that that's going to have to be done in the ballot box. It's going to have to be done in the elections. The fact of the matter is, first of all, that articles of impeachment have to be admitted onto the floor of the House to be voted on. And as long as impeachment can only happen in the House of Representatives. And impeachment is actually sort of like an indictment. It's not actually a conviction. And so the impeachment would have to happen in the House of Representatives, as it did with Bill Clinton, against Bill Clinton, as it did against Andrew Johnson back in the 1860s. And that impeachment, it has to make its way to the floor, and Denny Hastert would never allow that to happen. So the Democrats have to take control of the House for there to be articles of impeachment passed. And then once the House has decided, has officially impeached the president, as Bill Clinton actually was impeached, then, or indicted, then that impeachment goes to the Senate, where the senators have to vote whether or not to convict. And if they convict him of the impeachment in the Senate, then he's thrown out of office. If they don't convict him, he stays in office. So the Senate, in the case of both Bill Clinton and Andrew Johnson, in both cases, and Andrew Johnson, I think it was by one vote, and Bill Clinton, I don't remember how many votes it was by, but frankly, in both cases, they were not convicted in the Senate, so they didn't have to leave office. But to do either, you would have to have Democratic control of both the House and the Senate. Well, you'd have to have Democratic control of the House to have an impeachment in the House. You'd have to have Democratic control of the Senate to have conviction in the Senate, to even have the possibility of it. And those two things can only come about if enough of us get sufficiently active politically that the 2006 election can change control of the House and the Senate. And frankly, I think that we're heading in that direction. Does that make sense?
That gives me hope.
Yeah.
But the best case scenario would be that we could get control of the House and Senate, and then Cheney would already be indicted for his crimes. And certainly then you can't have him move into the presidency.
Yeah, and then you get Condi Rice. And oddly, I mean, you've got Dick Morris, who hung up on us on this program a few weeks ago, out there running around pushing the meme really hard that Condi Rice is going to be the Republican candidate for president and Hillary Clinton's going to be the Democratic candidate for president in 2008. And I'm increasingly thinking that maybe he's right, and that if Dick Cheney resigns, if Dick Cheney is implicated in the Treasongate scandal and or around the energy task force or around the lies. I mean, there's so many things that Cheney's got his fingers in that are dirty right now, for which he could be prosecuted or impeached or just, you know, it could be such a hassle that he becomes such a political liability that he simply says, I'm not feeling so well. I think I'm going to step down now and, you know, politely, gracefully exit stage left. And then George W. would put Condi Rice in his place, and, you know, we'll see. We'll see. But weird stuff. Thanks for the calls. Tony in Seattle, Washington. Tony, we have a half a minute left. What's on your mind?
Thanks, Tom. Then I'll be real quick. First of all, it's a pleasure on hold waiting for you because I get to hear Earthwatch. Let me encourage 1090 and all the other radio stations to please pick up earthwatch.com. Man, I've never seen somebody for commercials give information that is helpful to people like that. That's what
okay.
Right quick, to reparation. Man, they turn a blank face or any type of You know, they just look at you stupid when you talk about some type of reparation. And yes, yeah. The N-word is heavily used in all the main media to this day. At 12 o'clock in the daytime, you will hear him say, you know, I'm not going to go ahead and say it because it's out there enough. But I think that's just a disgrace. And we can't even go back and say that Lincoln freed the people. He freed the slaves. So all the white kids just look over at the black kids and say, you guys are still slaves. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's in their mind. Why can't they just say he freed the people? I mean, they rewrite the Bible all the time. Let's rewrite what, you know, Appomattox, what happened down there, and just make it plain that we're all people here trying to survive.
There you go, Tony. You're talking about the power of language. I mean, that was the point that Malcolm X made, where he talked about how the word black is used in so many different metaphoric contexts to describe negative things.
Yes.
You know, black marks and the black hole
exactly.
and all that kind of
all
thing.
Exactly. All those bad guys wear black and all that.
Right, yeah. And boy, I remember I must have been 17 when the Malcolm X's book came out, and I read that, and I thought, holy cow, you know, it's just, yeah.
Much so, love, Tom. One love.
Thank you much, Tony. Good to hear from you. Keep up the good work. Keep spreading the word. Next week. Yeah. Tomorrow, don't miss Bernie Sanders, as always. And if you want to know who really shot Kennedy, we're going to be telling you. We'll have a whole hour devoted to it tomorrow, so check it out. Be back with us. And remember, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Pass it along. Thanks for being with us today, friends. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.